Florence Howe is a founder and one of the leaders of a profound movement, one which has significantly transformed the social consciousness of America. The feminist movement, as translated and affected by such women as Ms. Howe, has delineated the importance of women's role in the past, the present, and will continue to do so as women and men move towards the future. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. Today, a conversation with Florence Howe, founder and director of the Feminist Press, writer, publisher, and editor, lifelong teacher, and activist. Ms. Howe, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have made it clear in some of your writings that you were not a born feminist, that there was something in you which evolved. Can you... I suppose I'm not asking you to start at the very beginning, but if you look back to Brooklyn, New York, where you were raised, what molded you to the woman who was not a feminist?
Well, I grew up in a family in which there were very carefully prescribed tasks for women to do and men to do, with one exception that I'll get to in a moment. That is when my younger brother dropped his pajamas just on the floor instead of either putting them under his pillow on the bed or in the drawer or in the hamper in the bathroom. I was told to pick these up, make his bed as well as mine, and so on. And I'd say, why can't he do it? And my mother would say, because he's a boy, he's not supposed to. You're a girl, you're supposed to. And I would say, that's unfair. And she would say, maybe, but the world is unfair. I mean, I don't think she said that when I was seven, but she certainly said that when I pursued that question when I was in my teens. The one difference in my household, which I didn't understand till I was much older, was that my mother went to work. She didn't stay home. And so, in part, the fact that I learned to iron when I was five, and I did housework from the time I was able to move a broom across the floor or make a bed or wash a dish, that fact had to do in part with the fact that my mother needed somebody to help her, since my father never lifted a finger, could not imagine putting his dirty clothes into the hamper. And of course, my father was a taxi driver and worked more than 14 hours a day, usually nights, and was very exhausted when he got home.
What did your mom do?
My mother was a bookkeeper by training, but she went to work for the first time in my memory as a riveter during the Second World War.
Rosie the Riveter.
She was Rosie because her name was Rosenfeld. So she was indeed Rosie the Riveter. She quit the way many women quit, out of patriotism. She had a very high-paying job then, certainly compared to what a bookkeeper could earn. But she was just the way she was supposed to be in this patriarchal society after the war was over. She quit to make room for men to be employed and went to a far lower-paying job as a bookkeeper.
There was a great call at that time for women to do just that, to return to the home.
Right,
return to the home.
In the 50s.
So you had a dual image then before you. You had the spoken word, the things that girls were to do, and your training in that area, but then you had the image of your mother, who was earning a living to support the family as well.
Right. She didn't get enough money from my father. She always had to beg for money. She often cried because there wasn't enough money, and I suspect now that my father gave her just what he felt like and used some for himself, what he used it for, whether he gambled. He certainly bet everyone I knew in that working class area played the numbers. He certainly did that, not that he ever won. But poor people do things like that to keep going. And I think my mother decided she'd had enough and went to work. My father was not happy with her working, never was, always complained about it. I think was more insistent that he not do anything at all to help her. because she had decided that she was going to work. And yet, of course, the family was much more comfortable, he included, because she did work. So you're quite right. There was complex bi-thinking here.
Sure.
Yeah.
We're talking today on Conversations with the founder of the Feminist Press, and for 20 years its director. From that background, what did you imagine for yourself in life as a child? What did you see that Florence was going to do when she grew up?
Oh, I knew from the time I was five that I was going to be an elementary school teacher. My mother had wanted to be one. Her father had said no. And so she projected all of her own wishes and hopes onto her daughter, who was first born, and I entered the kindergarten classroom knowing that I was going to be a teacher and that I was to do very well in school, and I was to model myself on the behavior of the teacher in the classroom. And until I was in sixth grade, all the teachers, of course, were female. So it was possible to think about that, about wanting to be a teacher. It was a possible career or whatever. For a young girl. And of course, from my mother's working class Jewish perspective, it was the right career because you could be home to take care of your children. They would be in school with you. And then if something happened to your husband, since my mother didn't regard men as particularly reliable, you could take care of yourself and your family.
So she supported you in that for several reasons, her own fulfillment as well as for yours and your safety as a woman.
Right. Right.
Did her father forbid her to become a teacher?
Yes.
Because of economics or because it was inappropriate?
Inappropriate.
Inappropriate.
Women, from his point of view, and he had emigrated to this country after spending 10 years floating around Europe and working as an insurance agent in Scotland. He came from the Middle East, from Galilee, from northern Palestine originally. And his notion was very strictly Orthodox Jewish, and he conducted himself as a rabbi and married an illiterate Russian emigre, 10 to 15 years his junior, and proceeded to have these three children. And my mother was the youngest of the three and the only girl and the only one who wanted to go to school. And he thought that was ridiculous. I mean, his wife was illiterate, and though he spoke six or seven languages and read and could write in them, including Hebrew and Yiddish, you know, and English and German and French and so on, he never taught his wife any language. And she spoke Yiddish. She did not speak Russian, so far as I can remember. But she certainly could read or write nothing and learn almost no English. Anyway, he forbade my mother. He didn't even want her to go to high school. It was her insistence that she go to high school since she had such good grades. He said, okay, she could go to high school, but she had to take a business course. So she did bookkeeping, stenography, typing, and she sneaked Spanish in on the side. She wanted to be a Spanish teacher. But he made her quit. She was 16, and she got a job, and he kept bringing home, this is my mother's story, he kept bringing home rabbis for her to marry, young rabbis for her to marry, and she would have to shave her head and wear a wig. And I mean, she refused, and she did not marry until she was 21. So she had 5 years of this so-called freedom. And then she married a man who had only a fourth grade education, had never been bar mitzvahed, but had never had the religious ceremony at 13, and was totally uneducated even in English. And that, of course, horrified my grandfather. I don't think he came to the wedding or spoke to the couple for at least a year, maybe more. But that was my mother's revenge. I think she lived to regret it.
Sure, sure.
But
this is Zaida that you're
talking about. This is Zaida, who when I was seven, Baba, who was Zaida's wife, these are the Russian and Hebrew words for grandmother and grandfather, Baba died in a tragic accident. really dreadful, and she was the person who I felt loved me most and loved me physically. And after she died, my grandfather came to live with us in a little room off the kitchen, and he lived with us there in that apartment for 3 years. And for whatever reasons he never explained, he decided to teach me Hebrew and Yiddish. Every afternoon after school, he would sit down at the kitchen table with me, and that's what I describe in the poem. And he would, I had just come home from school, my brother had just come home from school, and my brother would get to go out and play, and I would get to sit down with my grandfather, who never smiled, who was a very stern teacher, and who never praised me. My mother would come home from work at about 6, and she would say, I would still be at the books. I mean, we were at the books for 3 or 4 hours, and then he would give me homework to do for the next day on top of the homework I had from school. She would say, how did she do today, Pa? And my grandfather would say, for a girl, she's not bad. That was the most praise I got. For a girl, she's not bad. But he would mutter to himself that he was wasting his time. I couldn't please him. There was no way. And, of course, I never understood that I couldn't please him, because to teach a girl was very demeaning from his perspective. And yet there was no one else. Mm-hmm. And I think he foresaw his death. That's the only way I can make sense of it. My brother was 4.
Too young to learn.
Couldn't. My brother didn't learn to read till he was 10, in fact. He was one of those hyperactive kids. There was only me. And he taught me to read and write Yiddish. And, of course, I grew up in a bilingual household, so I certainly could understand Yiddish. And the script is very different from Hebrew script or from English script. I can still write some of it, but I've basically forgotten all that he taught me. When he died at 10, the lesson stopped.
You know, I have a question. This is a sad story you're telling. It is indeed. I'm reminded of a phrase, and I'm afraid I don't remember its authorship, but it is something to the effect of that the greatest wounds create the greatest energy, the greatest drive. I hear from you a forbidding elder, Zeta, who also taught you a great deal and held you to very high standards, even though you could never reach them, a mother who defied her place in life to go to work, to earn money, to make life softer, a grandmother who was very loving in the very years where you needed it. I wonder, I mean, your life is in many ways an extraordinary life, and I wonder if you look back at these hard times and see that they were the fuel.
Well, thank you, Susan. I don't often do that, but I think you're probably quite right. I should do that. Yeah, I certainly learned to be persistent. I watched my mother's persistence in the face of very few pleasures. Mm-hmm. And I think that working class and poor people do learn to put one day, like one foot in front of the other, and to take one day at a time and to get through life persisting despite what may be very cruel times. My father used to complain that I was a very unfriendly person. My father was a funny man who liked humor and who liked to be friendly. And if I walked down a street with him in the neighborhood, he would say hello to everyone. And he was extremely upset that I would never say hello to anyone at all, and that I was not ever a person who was demonstrably affectionate.
A hail fellow well met.
Yes. Yeah. My father could have been a double for Willie Loman. Huh. And he died a suicide. I guess that funny, manic part of him was only one side that he ever showed publicly, and he was really a very depressed man.
great difficulties inside.
Yeah. So there was his funny warmth, too, in my life. And he didn't commit suicide till I was 35, so I had some pleasures with him. He opposed my doing much of what I did. He really wanted me to lead the traditional life and to be that elementary school teacher that I had started out to be. But then when I was not going to, I think he, even more than my mother, appreciated what I was doing, though he knew when I left New York right after my Hunter College degree, I left New York to go to graduate school, he said that he knew I would never have a normal life. And he used that word normal, and he really was perfectly correct, though I was very scornful of that. I felt I was going to have it all. I was going to have husband, children, and profession. And I almost did, but I didn't. He was right in the end.
We're talking once again to Ms. Florence Howe. She is one of the founders and leaders over the past 20 years of the women's movement, feminist movement in the United States. She is with her then husband, the founder of the Feminist Press, a publishing house which has lived its 20-year life in New York City. We'll be talking about the Feminist Press later in the hour. I'm Susan McGinnis, and you're listening to Conversations. You have written about Mississippi and the Freedom Schools as the turning point in your life, in capital letters and boldface. What took you to the Summer of Freedom in 1964?
Well, a lot of different things, but most immediately my own freedom. I was divorced at that point. I had no children. I could risk my life. And I had just one life to risk. I'd given my parents my car so that they could take the first trip of their lives alone in a car, not a taxi.
Quite a gift.
And they went to New England and Canada and were delighted with it. I did not tell them where I was going because I knew they'd be terrified. And so I sent them off and explained to them that I didn't need my car because I don't remember what I told them. I was going to go do something else. And took a bus to Mississippi. But the other factor really had to do with my students. And it's a story that I think probably has happened to lots of teachers, that is, their students educated them. About a year before that summer, at least a year before that summer, sometime in 1963, some students asked me to drive them to a mall near where I was teaching. I was teaching it in Towson, Maryland at Goucher College, and the mall was in Towson. Maybe it was a little further down into Baltimore itself. Towson is a northern suburb. The mall was right next to Morgan State College, which was a college for black students. And Baltimore was as segregated as any southern city in the 60s still. The white Goucher female students were going to this mall where there was a picket organized by the Morgan students and joined by Hopkins and Towson State and various students from various colleges all around. It was a picket around a movie theater on this mall that backed the Morgan campus that did not allow black students into the theater. And my students, about six of them, asked if they could all pile into my car, and they had another car, but there were more students than they thought. So I said, certainly, I'd drive them. And I had done nothing in my life that one could call activist, beyond, I guess, stuffing envelopes for a political candidate at the University of Wisconsin, in opposition to Senator McCarthy. But I'd never done anything like a picket line. So I drove them down. I
you know, dropped them off, and I started to drive away. And I thought, as I started to drive out of this vast parking lot, I saw a lot of police arrive, and I thought, well, maybe they were in danger. So I parked the car and walked towards the movie theater just to see whether they were all right or not. And as they saw me coming, they applauded, thinking I was going to join them. And I was so embarrassed that I did join them. And then I was terrified because the police were not friendly to the picketers. There were people standing and jeering. They were not friendly to the picketers. And the students looked very vulnerable to me. And I was the only older, sort of middle-class-looking person on the picket line. I don't even remember what happened that night, but I do remember that there were picket lines after picket lines, and when I wasn't on them with students, I was bailing the students out of jail. That became my customary role on the campus, and the president at the time, who was a civil libertarian, I think was very grateful to me, very grateful that there was at least one person on the faculty who cared for these very energetic and brave students. They had to withstand not only the police and the jeers and taunts and the dangers, but they were also not popular on a very conservative campus. And I learned that I was not popular for having driven them. That is, the very next day, many faculty members told me I'd broken the law. And I wanted to know which law. And they were outraged that I didn't understand that it was breaking the law to participate in any of this. And I said I thought the law was all the other way around. And it really made me think. I mean, their hostility, some people stopped talking to me, saying I was aiding and abetting minors to be criminals. And I thought, this is, you know, it just got to be more and more berserk. And so that experience helped me begin to see how important the color line was. And then the experience in Mississippi was of another order entirely. But that's what got me into it.
When you arrived at Mississippi, did you see a world that you had not known existed? Or were you aware of...
Oh, no. I was... I mean, one can be aware, but the palpable experience is something else. I was not unaware. I did a lot of reading in preparation for that visit. I was terrified all the way down, mainly that I didn't know enough. How was I going to teach black history when I was such an amateur? How could I possibly teach black literature when I had only read five writers? And on in my skull, you know, I kept reading. It was a 24-hour bus ride, and a lot of it, obviously, at night. I had a little light, and I kept reading and reading, thinking I would get more stuff into my brain. I needn't have bothered. That wasn't what the summer was about. The summer was really about teaching me how to learn and teaching me how to teach, not through, you know, sort of churning out lots of facts that I then stuff into my students' heads, but talking with them. I revised my whole concept of teaching down there and learned a whole lot about our racist society down there. And as I say, it changed my life because I knew I was learning to be a good teacher, but I also knew that the students had something that, as a teacher, I never understood students needed to have, and that was what I called afterwards a subject. They had something to write about, and that having something to write about is half the battle in writing. That is, you can be the most superb technical writer, and some of my students at Goucher, who are middle class and came from the best schools in the country, were superb technical writers. They knew everything there was to know about writing, but they had nothing to say. The pieces they wrote were empty. The students in Mississippi, on the other hand, could not tell me where a period went and did not know much about spelling. But they had a subject. Their subject was freedom. They wanted it desperately. Their subject was blackness, the terrible things that had happened to them because they were black people. Also, their subject was strength. They felt that strength to fight for their freedom. They wrote the most magnificent poems. I have, there are a couple of them in this volume.
The volume to which
yes.
you're referring is The Myths of Coeducation, a book completed in 1983, if I remember correctly.
I think five.
Five. You have written something in that volume that affected me, and I wanted to reflect it back to you. On the Freedom Summer in Mississippi. To liberate oneself, and no one else can do it for you, you need not only the belief in the value and the possibility of freedom, without that nothing else is possible, but you need also an understanding of those social forces that have oppressed you. Without such knowledge powerful enough to include the means of change, freedom or consciousness is meaningless. That's what you were talking about when you were talking about that the children in Mississippi had something about which to write.
Mm-hmm. One of those children is was a 15-year-old named Alice Jackson, who became my daughter the next year. And she wrote one of these great poems. Mm-hmm. She's now a lawyer in California with a daughter of her own named Florence.
That's very nice.
Yes, yeah. And a son named Jack. And their names, this is all very unconscious and mysterious to me, their names mirror my name, and my brother's name was Jack. Only he was younger and I was older, and this is the reverse.
The reverse.
It's just very strange that it happened, because Alice didn't know that, really.
When you went back to Baltimore, you went back, you describe in your book, as a white woman who was a black woman, because you had a black child, and to have a black child was to be treated as a black woman.
It's true. That was the following summer. Yes, and I had many racist friends who told me that if I wanted to get housing, I would have to understand that we were a mixed couple at best, and that I probably could get housing in the white part of town only if I told people that she was my maid, which was quite ugly. I finally didn't do that, of course. I went and got housing for myself and my daughter, and because the landlord, looking at me, assumed my daughter was white, and when we moved in, he asked us to move out, but I had already signed a lease, and so I stayed. We broke the lease early. He was delighted, and I moved to Washington, where I had exactly the same problem and solved it in exactly the same way. Those were terrible days in Baltimore and Washington, when one, if one were a black person or a mixed couple, could not get housing. It's slightly better now. It isn't altogether gone, but it's slightly better now.
Referring again to your early thinking, you said on returning from Mississippi and in those first years back at Baltimore that you felt the issues were race and war, mm-hmm. and that
women could wait.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That women could wait.
Could wait.
When did it occur to you that women could not wait?
I guess by the end of the 60s, it was clear. I was, and that is late, you know. The National Organization for Women was founded in 66, I think. Mm-hmm. Betty Friedan's book was 63, and of course Simone de Beauvoir's book before then. It wasn't that I hadn't read. I spent a good deal of time right after Mississippi trying to find a curriculum for my writing students that would focus on their being women. Not because of feminism, but because I had figured out by then that if blackness was the subject, blackness and freedom were the subjects for black students in Mississippi, then whiteness didn't work. My students did not understand they were white or what that meant. But being female worked. It made them very angry for me to ask them about being female. They hated it. And they didn't like reading books by women. They wanted D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce and Hemingway and so forth. And I gave them D.H. Lawrence mainly because Sons and Lovers contains images of several females that I thought we could connect with in some way. And as a matter of fact, I kept asking for the story of one of those females, and eventually, after the feminist press was born, we had the story of one of those females in Daughter of Earth and Agnes Smedley.
Agnes Smedley, yes.
But I only could imagine such a story before, you know, the 70s. So I actually did teach about women, and in order to do that, I read Simone de Beauvoir in 1965. I read Doris Lessing and began writing about her. None of the essays I've written about Doris Lessing happened to be in Myths of Coeducation, but I wrote three essays which were published in The Nation and have been republished in other places. And I did a long interview with Doris Lessing. Mm-hmm. But I was not what I would call myself a feminist in those days at all. I certainly not a conscious, ideological, card-carrying feminist. I certainly spoke up for women. I certainly thought my students ought to think about themselves and their futures as well as husbands and children. But a lot of that came, I think, from my working class background and not necessarily from an ideological feminist point of view.
Which makes a great deal of sense.
Yeah. But I changed. I changed in part because of information. I was very unhappy by the end of the 60s that I couldn't deal with my literature courses. My students kept asking. I taught the 18th century. My students kept asking me about women in the 18th century. I was totally ignorant. They said, what did they look like? I went to the library and I, you know, got art history books, and I could see what, you know, the women men painted. But the range was very slight, with the exception of Hogarth's Shrimp Girl. You know, they were all duchesses. And what did women think? What did they do? How did they live? Did they go to school? I couldn't answer any of those questions. My students were very persistent about those questions. Why were they reading only male authors? Did women ever write? I didn't know the answers to any of those questions. And then, as I explained the other night, reading this Dick and Jane as Victims, reading this book about an analysis of children's, the images of males and females, girls and boys, in 132 widely used children's books absolutely appalled me. All the mommies, and this was, you know, books used in schools in the 60s, not historical. All the mommies were dumb. All the daddies were smart. All the daddies were white and tall and without any pot bellies, a briefcase in hand, going off to work for the day, coming back at the end of the day, still very clean and without even a beard on their faces or needing a shave. And mommies were always in aprons in the kitchen, never went to work. The children were always two, an older boy and a younger girl, and the cat and dog were there, and the cat's genders were determined in sizes. And the major thing, I think, that appalled me was how stupid mommies were. They had to wait for daddies to come home from work to get a balloon from out of a tree, and daddy would take the stepladder and step right outside the kitchen with the stepladder, put it under the tree, get the balloon, and mommy and the children would applaud daddy's brilliance. Well, that was very upsetting stuff. I read that at the same time as I looked at the PhD. Who got PhDs in English and the modern languages, because I had just taken on a job I hadn't wanted as chair of the Commission on the Status of Women in the Profession of the Modern Languages Association. And as I looked at these statistics, I could not understand them at all. 80% of all the undergraduates in English were women, and 20% were men. 80% of all the PhD candidates and those who got PhDs were men, and 20% were women. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. I looked at the grades of males and females. There were many more A students than there were among the women than there were among the men. What does that mean? B students among the men got into PhD programs. A students among the women never even tried, didn't even consider it. You couldn't say it was discrimination. You had to say it was something else. And that got me into women's studies. what got me to the feminist press was not being able to answer any of my students' questions.
Huh. There is nothing there. We must find a place to put all that information.
Weren't there books? Mm-hmm. And the feminist press started by doing children's books, actually, in part because a woman in Baltimore who had a 7-year-old who wanted to be a doctor asked for a book about lady doctors, and she searched not only Baltimore but New York and the country over, and she could not find a single book about a doctor in print in 1970, about a doctor who was a girl or a woman. And I had just seen a Chinese children's book that some Canadians had given me, because we weren't getting anything from China at that point, that was called I Want to Be a Doctor, in which the doctor is a fat little 5-year-old girl, and her brother, who's maybe 4 or 3, is a fat little 4-year-old nurse. And there is a rocking horse that's sick, and she takes out her bag, which is filled with tools, right? And she saws a piece of wood and then nails it in, and she fixes this is the lady doctor, the little girl, fixes the rocking horse. And I handed that book to a Goucher student, a sophomore named Barbara Danish, and I said, Barbara, let's have an American version of this book. The Chinese won't mind. They'll be very happy, I'm sure, that we're stealing their book. We'll give them credit on the copyright page. Barbara, just do an American version. Don't change anything. And Barbara was an undergraduate who had filled my office with dragons. I mean filled. Paper mache, paintings. I said, Barbara, please, I know how talented you are. I know how good you are at stories and drawings. No dragons. Of course, that was the wrong thing to say. She came back literally 20 minutes later with the story, with some drawings, at least quite a lot of sketches. And the story was called The Dragon and the Doctor. And there was a little girl who was a doctor and a little boy who was a nurse and a huge orange dragon who had a sick tail. And in his tail there was a zipper. And the doctor discovers the zipper, opens up the zipper, and out tumbles, a treasure, a whole treasure of, or treasury, rather, of toys. She takes them all out, and then the dragon feels better. Hmm. And then he takes them for a ride on her, on his or her, I don't know what gender the dragon is, tail. And it's absolutely delightful, and that was our first book.
Well, let me reintroduce you. This is Florence Howe. She was educated at Hunter College, from which she graduated cum laude and was admitted to Phi Beta Kappa. Her master's is from Smith. She did further studies at the University of Wisconsin, and although she describes herself as a PhD dropout, she has honorary doctorate of humane letters from New England College, 1977, Skidmore College in 1979, and from DePauw University in 1987. And, as we've mentioned, she is the founder of the Feminist Press and its director for the past 20 years of its life. It must seem remarkable to have a 20th anniversary.
Yes, and actually I am a co-founder with at least one person, my ex-husband, and with a number of other people who worked with us through that early year, and then we moved to New York from Baltimore, and no one in Baltimore wanted to keep the press, and so it moved with us and wound up in my office, where indeed, since my ex-husband went off to do some other kind of work, it really was my charge and has been more or less my charge since then, though I have not been officially director. I have been president of the corporation, the nonprofit tax-exempt corporation, since its beginning, but I've been director only really for the past 4 years. Before that, I was co-director with one other person, and before that, starting around 1980, co-director with two other persons. But it has grown, and it is amazing to me to see it 20 years old. I never imagined until the 10th birthday that it would last more than a year at a time. But at the 10th birthday, I began to have a glimpse of the future, and I think it does have a future. It certainly has lots of work still undone.
Some of your best-known works, The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, you've told me this is the bestseller.
Well, it's a tiny book. We still sell it for $4.50. It's a wonderful story with an exemplary afterword. All of our books have exemplary afterwords. In other words, we anticipate that most people will never have read this literature in school. Most teachers who want to use it in their classrooms will not have read it in college or graduate school, and so we provide the means to help people to teach as well as to enjoy pieces of literature. And so this little book has sold about 200,000 copies in the years since 1973 when it was first produced. It's also available in dozens of anthologies. But lots of people want this, the feel of this little book, which is so lovely, and the look of it. And we really have worked hard to keep the price at $4.50, given the, you know, the rise in the cost of paper and the rise in the cost of books generally.
You've done much, it seems to me, to bring a hidden literature to the fore, to undo the curtains across the stage of women writers in general and Black women writers
in particular.
Well.
Yes, and now we're doing Indian women writers, that is, writers of India. Women Writing in India, 600 BC to the present, is the name of a two-volume work that we will be publishing, the first volume of which will be out in bookstores by the end of December, and the second volume probably early in 1992. First volume goes to the early 20th century. And there are other works from other countries, as well as continuing work on the U.S. that we are producing.
Is this decision to go international, does it mark a change in the feminist press?
We started that. We started to move in that direction in 1980, and we certainly had, we have produced books in that direction in the 80s. But we are doing even more of that for the 90s. Partly it's that there are many American presses now that have begun to do what we started to do 20 years ago. So that we still have some work to do there. And we generally do what other presses won't if we think that it's essential. And it's not, I mean, many people come to us and they want us to publish them, and they prefer us rather than a university press or a trade press because they know that our catalog is filled with books that teachers use, and the teachers will turn to our catalog sooner than to a university press catalog or a trade catalog because everything in it has gone through enormous testing process so that we really believe every book in there is useful in the classroom, and we don't publish books that are not useful in the classroom. So it's especially good if you want to get your book, if you think your book is good for the curriculum. And it's not a textbook because we don't publish textbooks as such. Our catalog is very handy. And so a number of novelists, significant novelists, have said, my book is out of print. I'd like you to be its publisher because I know that you're not going to remainder it. We don't remainder anything.
Remaindering means?
Remaindering means deciding at the end of 1 year that you can't sell the 10,000 you printed, and so you give them to Marlborough Books or some such place that will sell them for $1 or $2. That's remaindering.
And you keep books under your title and in...
And in print, we've not remaindered anything. And some of our books, as I say, are from the early years, 1972, 73. Five of our 12 bestsellers are still from 1972-73. And if a book doesn't sell well, it's because we believe we haven't marketed it well enough. And the reason we don't market sometimes well enough is that we don't often have we never have money for ads. You'll never see an ad We do mailings to people on our mailing list. So if you want to get on our mailing list and you want a free catalog, that's the best way to market, because our catalogs are readable. And we include a lot of information about every book, even the oldest books, not only the brand new books, so that you can tell from reading the catalog whether you want the book or not. We don't ever say things like, this is a marvelous book, the New York Times.
Right.
We don't put such language in the catalog. We don't bother, because everybody can, you know, do that. We actually describe the book, even if it's one that was published 15 years ago. So that's the way we market. And if we're not marketing well enough, it's because we don't have the money. We have to raise $200,000 each year in addition to the amount of money we raise by selling books in order to keep going.
And you are the chief fundraiser and cheerleader.
I am the chief fundraiser and cheerleader,
right.
Yes. Although I do have a lot of help. I have a wonderful board of directors. I have a wonderful staff. I have excellent consultants. And a very loyal tribe of donors and supporters. We print everybody's name inside the cover of the catalog. Everybody who's given us more than $100 in any given year gets to be inside the cover of the catalog. And people give not only money, but they give time and resources, too. And we have absolutely wonderful authors. Of course, without the authors, we couldn't exist.
Do you see in some ways... I see that the feminist press is something that marries at least two loves in your life. One is teaching, and the other is transformation of society to reflect more and more people and their interests and needs, your move towards the human potential. I also see that the feminist press is a family. Is it also that? And
it's
how is
my
it that?
Family. You're uh-huh. right. Quite right. I don't know how you could possibly have known this, Susan, since you just set eyes on me. But you are quite right. The feminist press has become my family, indeed.
Sounds quite joyous and supportive in its way, although it's a lot of hard work.
Yes, and sometimes it's very lonely, too. For me as an individual, because while it may be my family, I am not necessarily its family. You have to remember that and laugh about it a little bit.
Always.
Yes.
We are talking today with Ms. Florence Howe, as we've just talked about, one of the co-founders of the Feminist Press and its driving force for the past 20 years. She is also a teacher. She has taught at City College of New York from 1987 until now. Before that, the State University of New York at Old Westbury for 16 years, your longest tenure, is that right? Goucher was 11 years prior to that. And as she was becoming a teacher, University of Wisconsin, Hofstra, and Queens College, all places where she has taught. One of the classes that you've mentioned in this hour, although not by name, is Identity and Expression, a writing course for women, which you have written about in some of your written works. Is that a class that was as much a catalyst for growth for you as for your students?
Oh, yes. That probably was my CR group.
Consciousness raising from the
70s. Yes, probably. I never was in a formal CR group. But I used to sit in a circle with my students, and we would talk, because I believe that good writing came out of a tripart process of talking, reading, and thinking. Then one got to writing, okay? And talking was very important because it allowed the students to share ideas and to express ideas verbally, and sometimes to get so stimulated that they could go away and write. The reading was very important to start the talking. It's always easier for students to talk about a character in a book they've read than to talk about themselves. They're shy, and quite understandably, shy to trust a strange group with their own personal lives. And so it's much easier to talk about Miriam, let's say, in Sons and Lovers and the problems she has with Paul Morrell than to talk about the problems that Judy in Class is having with her boyfriend. So we do a lot of, or we did a lot of reading and a lot of talking. And for me, it was especially instructive because my students were all middle class and I was working class. And they had none of the values that I had, and I had none that they had. And so it's always instructive, that is, to learn another culture, and I think I learned another culture in that way. Uh-huh. Not always consciously, because, you know, consciousness takes a long time to hone and develop, and one can always look back and see it happening, and often in the midst of great happenings, one is not aware of what is going on. I'm sure you've had this experience.
The young women of today seem, and I don't know whether this is myth, rumor, or reality, but they seem to believe that they don't have a need for a feminist movement. How do you assess that in terms of its truth or reality? And if true, how do you feel about it?
Well, I think some do and some don't. First of all, I don't think it's easy to generalize. You can. There were some in my audience here who, the large audience, there were some students who came who not only felt themselves part of a women's movement but wanted a women's studies program instantly created to support them in that work. There were lots of young women who went on the pro-abortion demonstrations last year. And there are lots of young women who feel very connected. At the same time, there are also lots who, and I don't know what proportion is accurate, there are lots who feel the battle's over and who don't want to know that there are still things to be done. And I think they'll just have to discover for themselves, either at college or in the workplace, it's easier in the workplace, or in life with a male partner, that the struggle is not over at all. Black people certainly know that. I'm sure Alaskan Natives know that, if they're politically conscious, that in some ways for them life has gotten harder than it was maybe 5 years ago. People are more careless, not less careless. The economy is worsened, and so it is harder for, it's always harder for members of minority groups and white women. It's always harder when the economy is down. So I think also that consciousness moves relatively slowly in periods when there isn't an active street movement. And unless we get one around the question of abortion again, we don't have in sight an active street movement.
Is your sense that movements are cyclic? Do they? We have, for example, seen in our history as women, the suffrage movement came mm-hmm. and went a couple of times and emerged into a 70-year battle for the
vote. Right.
And then quieted again, and then reemerged on the heels of civil rights.
Well, I think it quieted because people thought gaining the suffrage was going to be enough. I mean, I don't think many people understood that gaining the suffrage really was the beginning of gaining the right to run for office. If anybody had understood that coherently, the organizations that gained women the suffrage would not have all been abandoned. All but three of them were abandoned. I think the League of Women Voters is one of the few that went on. Maybe Girls Clubs of America is another one. I mean, I used to know the three organizations that continued. Everything else was a pantheon of organizations. Everything else disbanded. Well, if we had understood that the entrance of women into higher education, which was another battle being fought along with suffrage, that those two battles were only one, you know, a notch, and that they needed to continue, there wouldn't have been this. Now, in some ways, not winning ERA has helped us, because I think if we had won ERA, we would have disbanded all these organizations again. but we've gone on. And I think we need to go on. I don't think the movement is as gone as it was after 1920. I think what disturbs people who don't, who haven't been in it and who go looking for it, what disturbs people is that they don't really know where to look. Major organizations now and major institutions like universities are headed by women who are part of the movement. Donna Shalala, for instance, who heads the University of Wisconsin at Madison, is one of the leaders of the feminist movement. Let me give you another example. Margaret Gates, who is head of Girls Clubs of America, is one of the leaders of the women's movement and one of the founders of the Center for Women Policy Studies in Washington, about to have its 20th birthday. So I could give you a dozen more examples of women who are seemingly out of the movement into heading a mainstream organization. The woman who heads the Girl Scouts and is also now Gwendolyn Baker, who is also now a member of the Board of Regents. The Board of Education, one of the trustees of the Board of Education of the City of New York, really important job. She's one of the leaders of the feminist movement.
So these are now women who have entered the fabric and are using their consciousness.
Right. Barbara Mikulski.
Very generally.
Pat's name from Colorado.
Schroeder.
Pat Schroeder. Patsy Mink. I mean, these are all congresswomen. So I think when you say, where is the women's movement, you see?
All around us.
It is all around us. And I think there is the hope in the new Ms. magazine. I hope you've seen it. Absolutely beautiful and beyond. For listeners who haven't seen it, here's a little plug for Ms. magazine. There are now, if you have a copy of issue one or issue two, you have a collector's item because they were sold out. I would give $25 for a copy of issue one at this point. I need it to send to India to an author, and I want one for Tilly Olson, who's been nagging me for one. I can't find one except for the one that I have.
There is money to be made.
And I
if you're willing to give it
up. The last of Robin Morgan's copies. Issue three has just hit the stands, and everybody should know there are 110,000 subscribers, not the 40,000 that we all hoped and prayed for to start with. And it's just beautiful. Each issue is more beautiful than the previous one.
It's a stunning reintroduction, I think.
Yes, yes. So the movement is not dead.
Florence Howe, I want to thank you very much for an hour with us here on Conversations. It has been a pleasure. Once again, this is a co-founder and the main force behind the Feminist Press for the 20 years of its existence. It is now having its 20th anniversary in 1990. Much work in the past for the women's movement, for the civil rights movement, and I expect much more to come.
We've just won a big prize, you should know. We've won the Publishers Weekly's special citation for 20 years of creative publishing.
Congratulations.
Thank you,
Florence Howe. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join us again next week. Are you ready? We're rolling.
You may have a free copy of the Feminist Press catalog by writing to Florence Howe, Feminist Press at the City University of New York. Did I say that again? Florence Howe, H-O-W-E, at the City University of New York, 311 East 94th Street, 94, New York, New York, 10128. New York, New York, 10128.
And if you missed any of that, give us a call at 474-5000, and we'll let you know.